Hola, mi amores! It's your girl, E, and this is The Call, where we hear from wildly inspiring and interesting women about their journey to answer their life's calling. This week, Time Magazine decided to honor Silence Breakers as their Person of the Year. I love the way that sounds. It's kind of like Marvel superheroes. And they are superheroes. They're the women, and a handful of men, who set off a national reckoning over the prevalence of sexual harassment. And while I did have a few, questions about who they put on the cover, Taylor Swift instead of the founder of Me Too, Tarana Burke, I couldn't agree more that this year has been a watershed year for women speaking about things we're not supposed to talk about, like sexual harassment and sexual assault and even the R word, rape, which is apparently totally cool when a male comic says, but not so when a woman speaks up about it. It takes a lot to tell your story, and it takes an extra level of courage to not just speak up, but to fight back against the system that victimizes you and try to change it. This week's guest, Amanda Nguyen, knows all about that. In 2013, while she was still a student at Harvard, Amanda was raped. And according to her, what followed after that was an even greater injustice. She'll talk about how horrifying the system is for rape survivors to navigate and how little rights they have. One injustice in particular had to do with her rape kit. I'll let her explain that, but just for context, for those of you who don't know, a rape kit is the forensic evidence that's collected after sexual assault. That injustice, which she'll explain, and her overall journey to get justice after her rape inspired her to draft and advocate for what became known as the Sexual Assault Survivors' Rights Act. It's a bill that, thanks to Amanda's work and the work of many others, actually passed unanimously in Congress last year. It's now a landmark piece of civil and victims' rights legislation that establishes, for the very first time, federal rights for survivors of sexual assault and rape. So in case you missed it, this is a 24-year-old survivor who helped pass historic legislation simply by fighting for her own rights. She's since founded an organization called RISE, which helps other survivors pen their own legislation. I was super excited to talk to her because she's an example of just how possible change is. I'm grateful for her and for all the other silence breakers out there. So get ready to be inspired by Amanda Nguyen here on The Call. Amanda, thank you for joining me on The Call.
Thank you for having me.
I'm so excited to chat with you because when we first launched this show about a year and a half ago, you were actually exactly the kind of guest that we had in mind. The impetus behind the show was, you know, hearing from women who were kind of stepping up in this moment and responding to a call, a pull on their lives to do something big and bold and to make a difference. And that really, really characterizes your story and your work in the world. So I'm glad we're getting a chance to talk to you today.
Thank you so much.
So let's take it back and tell me first about little Amanda. When you were growing up, well, first of all, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Corona, California. So Southern California. I tell everybody it's near Anaheim. And then if their lights, you know, don't go on, then I say it's near Disneyland.
Got it. Really knows it. Right. And what did you want to be when you were a little girl?
I wanted to be president of the United States and I wanted to be an astronaut.
I love that. I think both are probably still very, very possible. Which is so funny considering the context now, right? Like, there's still an opening to be the first woman president of the United States. But so you wanted to be an astronaut. That's amazing. And then I know since then you've actually interned at NASA, right?
Yep, I did. And then I also worked at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics on exoplanets. So it's definitely a dream, present tense dream still.
Present tense. I love that. I read this quote that you had when you were explaining how astronauts experience the overview effect. And you said it's, you know, when astronauts see Earth for the first time, they leave. I love the way you described it here. They leave as technicians, but return as humanitarians with an understanding that we're all on this Earth together, which is so beautiful. And I want to know, what experiences have given you an overview effect, like have shown you or reminded you that we're all here together, we're all in this thing together, and kind of giving you that big picture look at life?
Geez, where do I start? I think the one that comes to mind is I was sitting on the balcony in Congress. I was sitting on the balcony watching senators come and place their vote for this this bill that I wrote. And, you know, when I started this, I was 24. And so, understandably, historically, laws get passed like 10 to 15 years on average for one single bill, usually with millions of dollars, lots of powerful people. And there's like 24-year-old me plus like my group of friends who are around my age. And we're like, yeah, we're going to change the nation. And you know what? We did. And I was sitting there. I was watching Elizabeth Warren get on the floor, and I was watching Jeff Sessions get on the floor and vote. And they have this card. You can see it. It's a green card to indicate yes, like yay or nay. Mm-hmm. We have framed in our office this chart that tells, you know, where each senator sits. And we had started tallying the votes as they came in. And I remember at that moment when it hit the majority, and we knew we were going to pass. Like, I remember just crying. So the chart isn't filled, even though it was a unanimous vote. And it's one of those moments where I realized, wow, like, change can actually happen.
I love that. You said it real slick, right? Like, oh, it's just this bill I wrote. Like, that's a normal thing. But it's not. How did you, you know, you said, you talked about how it usually takes a very, very long time and a massive coalition and a lot, frankly, and I've worked in politics and worked in Washington, and let's be honest, a lot of money to move legislation to get bills passed. Let's start at the beginning of that story. Why this bill? How did it come about? And when did you decide that's something I want to do? This is important to me.
Yeah, well, I made the decision to start RISE from a very personal place. You know, I'm a rape survivor, and that law that I'm talking about is the Sexual Assault Survivor Bill of Rights. And it was because I needed civil rights, and I didn't think that there would be anybody else who could write it. So I wrote it. I remember walking out of the hospital the night after, you know, I was raped, and I felt so alone. And I remember trying to figure out what my rights were, and it was so hard. It was a labyrinth, and I had these immense resources. I was a student at Harvard at the time. I had, you know, professors, law professors, who were like one of the best in the nation on this issue. And even all of us together collectively were struggling really hard to figure out, well, what are my rights? When do my rape kits get processed? Or are they destroyed? How do you track? I mean, there was just so many things that were so unclear because there's no standard operating procedure. And I decided, after walking into my local area rape crisis center and seeing that the waiting room was filled, that, wow, you know, my story is not mine alone. And that if I was going through this with my resources, mm-hmm. what is it like for somebody else who doesn't have that? And so after researching and finding out that in other states, they don't destroy rape kits, like they do in Massachusetts, or they did in Massachusetts before my law. What that means is that justice depends on geography, that, you know, two survivors in two different states have two completely different sets of rights. I decided to rewrite the law. And it comes from a very deep belief in equality under the law, and mm-hmm. also in our ability to create change, especially in a country that keeps telling us that not only is it our right, but it's also our responsibility.
Right. As surprised and kind of unaware as you were of all the complexities involved in identifying what your rights were as a rape survivor, I imagine that the average person also has just as much surprise and just as much ignorance, especially someone who has not had that experience. You said, you know, if you're dealing with this as someone with resources, imagine what other people are experiencing. What are other people experiencing, right? Like, what is that process like? Because what the general public sees is Law & Order SVU, right?
Yep.
Like, this thing happens, and then, you know, Olivia Benson comes in, and she convinces me to report. I report, and then, you know, the asshole goes to jail, which is not, A, what normally happens, and B, it's certainly not that simple. So walk us through the process and some of the challenges and confusion that were embedded in it.
Yeah, well, in some states, survivors don't have access to their own police report. In some states, rape kits are still destroyed. So, for instance, in New York destroys rape kits in 30 days. And there's just been reports out of, I think, Broadly journalists who found that there were 840 rape kits that were destroyed in the past 5 years. In fact, one of our organizers in New York had her rape kit destroyed by New York. Another, you know, right that we fight for is that in some cases, survivors don't have access to their own medical information within their forensic medical examination. You know, and as a patient, technically you're supposed to have that right. But because HIPAA, the Patient Rights Act that passed, didn't specifically codify the right for rape survivors and right for the cases of rape or sexual assault. That's why these incidences are happening, and that's why codifying civil rights is so important. In some cases, rape survivors are being billed. And yeah, kits can cost up to $2,000, and we've had people have creditors call their homes. So
it's disgusting.
Yeah, it really is. And like in no other crime would you have to pay for the collection of evidence. You know, and that's why this is a civil rights issue, because these things that are happening, they don't happen to other victims of other crimes. And they're clear double standards. So, for instance, the case, you know, the right that started this entire movement was very personal to me. It was that in Massachusetts, before my law, kits were could be destroyed in 6 months, even if the statute of limitations is 15 years. And the double standard for that is that convicted rapists have the right to hold on to the evidence for the duration of their conviction. But survivors don't have the right to hold on to the evidence for the duration of the statute of limitations. Yeah. So, and like, no other crime is treated right. Like, murder. You don't destroy evidence in murder cases.
Right.
So, yeah. So, after presenting this really clearly to people, you know, everybody has a stake in this. You know, the innocence community needs that DNA evidence to exonerate people, and law enforcement officers want to have evidence so that it could help them do their jobs. And obviously for the survivors, it helps get justice. So after getting everybody to see that this is, you know, the right thing to do, folks were on board.
Now, that sounds so clear-cut, right? As for me, in my ears, as someone who is pro-justice for absolutely everyone and in every situation, that sounds logical. And yet, we know that the things that sound logical, that sound so clearly in line with the values that our country purports to have, right, and to hold, often are met with pushback still, no matter what, right? So what was some of the pushback, if any, that you received personally or just, you know, in terms of passing legislation?
I think the first time I heard a politician tell me, I don't think this would be politically advantageous for me, was really surprising.
Wow.
Yeah, I have had people debate the political feasibility of my own human right in front of me. And I sometimes I'm like, okay, kudos for being blunt and honest, I guess.
But also,
your job is to serve. Yeah, that was a hard pill to swallow. And of course, not everybody agreed to everything. There were rights we had to sacrifice in order to get something that went through unanimously. And we worked really hard to make sure that when we brought people to the table, they felt like they were being heard. You know, I think that partisanship is a big disease in this country right now. And there are people who are literally moving. Like the demographics of this country are moving because people want to be closer to a community that reflects their own political beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to have a functional democracy, people need to hash things out. And we need to be able to climb over these empathy walls and sit in them. And it could be really uncomfortable, but it's going to be what it takes for us to make change together.
Yeah. I mean, even hearing that, in some ways, it's hopeful, and it's a beautiful goal to think that we can all come together. And it's, I think, an ideal. It's what we're working for. But when you say hash things out, I go back to that statement of that you actually had to explain to someone who sat in your face and, you know, told you that your human rights were not politically feasible, right? Like, I think a lot of folks are feeling the frustration of having to hash out their value and their worth and their rights as human beings and as Americans. And I think that's the moment we're in now, too, where a lot of that political divide is because for so long, women and people of color and LGBT folks have come to the table and had to explain why they are worthy of the same rights as everyone else. So did you ever get to a point in this process and fighting for this bill and even, you know, in your work now, where you just get frustrated that you're even having to have these conversations?
Oh, totally. Totally. I remember the first time that I went and talked to politicians. It was like 6 straight hours of me telling my trauma and people telling me that. People just being like, oh, I don't know if my constituents really care about this, or like, I have a re-election to run right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I went home and I cried. And I remember I was just praying and I was like, God, I just need one person to tell me that they love me. And the next day, as a pathological optimist I was, I went up, I did the same thing. I was in an Uber ride to the United States Senate, and this driver, he was this really big stoic man, didn't really talk, kind of intimidating, but he saw I was going to the Senate. And so at the end of the ride, he asked me why, and I told him why I was going. And this complete stranger started crying. I mean, this man who was once intimidating, his eyes just started welling up with tears. And he turned to me and he said, my daughter is a rape survivor. And when she went to the police, you know, this happened, and we need to change this system. And when he stopped the car, he said, can I shake your hand? Thank you so much for fighting for my daughter. Has anyone told you that they love you today? I just want to say I love you. And so this work gets really hard, and it's totally frustrating. And, you know, people, it is an emotional labor to have to do this and tell the story. But at the end of the day, there are people like that father, and I know it impacts so many lives. Like, I will never forget that dad.
That's a beautiful story. And it makes me think about how many, not just women's lives, but how many human lives overall are going to be changed by this work, are going to be impacted by this work. How has this whole experience changed you? We started off asking, like, who was little Amanda, right? And you grew up in Southern California and you wanted to be an astronaut, and you still want to be an astronaut. But in what ways has this experience, whether we're talking about, the assault, the rape, or just this experience of then fighting for your rights on behalf of others, how has that changed you? Who is Amanda today that's different?
I think as a kid, before folks, you know, before the world jades you, you have this sense of limitless, that people tell you you can be anything you want to be when you grow up, and you should dream and have those dreams be big. And I still feel the exact same way. So after being able to propose a law and see it through and have it unanimous, and by the way, RISE has passed a total of 12 laws. So after the federal law was passed, states came and also were inspired to pass state versions of the law. That's what I'm fighting for now.
Yeah.
And international laws were passed as well. It really became clear to me that two things. First, which is more optimistic, that we absolutely have the ability to shape the world around us. And the one of the biggest factors to that is just by starting, just by doing. You know, I want people to know that you're not powerless and that no one can make us invisible when we demand to be seen. And the second thing, which is just a real honesty, is that for people of color, for women of color, it does sometimes, you know, you have to work twice as hard to get half as far. Mm-hmm. And it just, the amount of work that we collectively at Rise, most of us are women, most of us are people of color, most of us are young, mm-hmm. That we had to pour into this was a lot. And a lot of that work was just to get validated. You know, we'd show up into members of Congress's offices and people would think that we're, you know, interns. Mm-hmm. I remember once I was in an office and the person in front really was not very nice until she recognized me in a magazine she was holding.
Wow.
Yeah. And then the congresswoman walked out and I was like, oh, man. but yeah, that's just honesty.
Yeah. Yeah. And you've gotten a lot of attention now because of this, right? So that someone can recognize you in a magazine or for being on, you know, a 30 under 30 list, a 40 under 40 list, a Young Leader Award. How do you feel about all of that attention?
Well, it shouldn't take that for people to realize that these civil rights are important. But I'm really grateful for people to cover this issue and to put a spotlight on these stories. And it's not only my story, but it's all of the risers collectively, the work that they do, the work that we all do together to push this movement forward. It's a constant drumbeat. And sometimes people tell us, you know, like, oh, it's not the right time right now, but there's never a more convenient season to start creating change. Mm-hmm. And again, I want people to know that the most powerful tool that they have is their voices. And we all have that.
Mm-hmm. I hear some people, and I've heard some people since, certainly since 2016 and the Women's March, where there's been this shift from folks who hadn't previously considered themselves activists, participating in activism and doing bolder things that they wouldn't have ordinarily done. I've heard some concerns since then about folks saying, but I don't want this to define me, right? Like, I'm not a full-time activist. I have a job. I'm a creative. I'm, you know, fill in the blank of whatever else their passions are and their professions are. It sounds like you're not concerned about that, right? Like, you're like, oh, I very much still intend to be the president of the United States and an astronaut. And also, I just happen to be running this amazing organization. Do you worry about those two things? How your life as an activist and kind of this public profile impacts the rest of your kind of ambitions and dreams?
I'm going to rocket launch next week. I still
yes.
want to get off this earth.
Don't we all?
Look, if Elon Musk can do Tesla and PayPal and just everything that he does, mm-hmm. then everybody can do whatever it is that they want to do. I do think that it is human nature to want to label, put things in categories so that we easily understand and assess one another. But at the end of the day, humans are messy and we have many dreams and many hopes and fears. And the sooner that we realize that we can be all these different things, the sooner we can be happier. Mm-hmm. I want people to know that you can fight for a cause and not let that define you. I want survivors to know this too, that you could share your story and not let that define you. This is definitely a privilege. We are in a better time for it now, especially now when people are coming out with their Me Too stories. Mm-hmm. And I know that that wasn't true even just a couple years ago. But it is okay to share your story, and it's nothing to be ashamed about, because it's, first of all, not your fault. Mm-hmm. And then also, you can do whatever it is in your job and also fight for things. it's possible to do all of these things.
You talked about the moment that we're in right now and the Me Too movement, which was founded by Tarana Burke, and kind of this this amazing outpouring of women's voices. And it's not just the outpouring of women's voices that's amazing, but it's that everyone else is paying attention to them and listening to those voices that have always been there. Obviously, that's a beautiful thing. What do you find maybe, I don't know, unhelpful or annoying about, if anything, about this moment, right? Like, I talked to some folks who are like, this is great, but I hope that people don't do this in response. Or, gosh, but I always hear, I get the same question over and over again now that this is happening. Is there anything that people should be wary of in this amazing, powerful moment?
Yeah, well, it's a double-edged sword, right? Because I think a lot of people are exhilarated by the community and empowerment that's out there, but it can be also triggering and exhausting. I mean, my Facebook feed was filled with these Me Too stories. And I work in this, like I know the statistics on it, but it was still so, so exhausting to see. Mm-hmm. Honestly, I'm just really thrilled that we're in this moment and people are being held accountable. Can you believe it? People are being held accountable.
Right.
Wow.
That's such a surprise.
Yeah, I know. Whoa. So honestly, I'd like to see more people in power speak up. And I'd like to see men. I'd like to see men. And not that there are no male survivors. There are male survivors. Bless Terry Crews for being out there talking.
Yes.
But I'd like to see men be part of the conversation because this conversation needs to have everyone at the table.
What kind of conversations do you have with men now or since you started this work?
Oh, great question. A lot of men in my life have come to me and asked me, hey, I want to be a part of this conversation and how do I do so in a respectful way? And I really like that question because some people may feel, some men, I mean, may feel like it's not their place or they want to talk, but they don't know how. And the best way to do that is just to ask the women in your life.
So when they've asked you that, what do you tell them?
It depends on every situation, but being honest and being proactive about wanting to create a safe space to talk about issues mm-hmm. is a really good first step.
So you talked about men in your life and that, you know, you've had these great conversations with them. I'm so curious, what do your parents feel about this turn of events in your life? Like, right, so obviously it starts with this horrific thing that has happened to their daughter. And then beyond that, you know, they get to see this amazing, powerful, strong, and wildly successful kind of trajectory happen as a result. But prior to that, I don't know if you were, you know, super vocal, if you've always been an activist, or if this was a huge turning point for you. And if it was, how do your parents feel about it?
Well, I'm really, really grateful to the love and community that has surrounded me. And I'm so proud of my heritage. So my parents are refugees. My mother was a boat refugee. So her story is incredible from Vietnam. A lot of the strength that I have drawn from being able to fight, to survive, is largely due to these values and mm-hmm. the values that I was brought up with. You know, she went into death to seek life. And also, both of them know and have taught me the cost of freedom and that it's not free. And that's one of the reasons why I probably chose to write the law, because I don't take for granted democracy. I grew up understanding how valuable it is and the sacrifices that my family has had to go through in order to give me the privilege of being born in this country and being able to fight and speak up for what I believe in and what I believe this country should do.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that's probably one of the reasons why I chose to do this.
How do you take care of yourself in the process of all this, right? Freedom isn't free. It's hard work, as you said, especially if you're a woman, especially if you're a woman of color, especially if you're someone who, you know, is constantly being questioned, especially when it's coming from a very deeply personal place. Like, all of these things make this pretty exhausting, draining, heavy work. How do you take care of yourself and lift yourself up?
Yeah, I have a menu of self-care. It's literally drawn out like a restaurant menu.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it has like hors d'oeuvres, so it's like small things. Like,
wait, did you come up with that yourself?
Yes, I did.
You know everybody's going to steal that because that's perfect.
Please do. I want people to self-care. Yeah, so like the hors d'oeuvres is like, you know, maybe have a face mask on or text a friend, Skype a friend, go out and get yourself cider. And then there's small plates. So it's like, take time to read today, or go play the piano. And then there are what I call soul food. So I compose music. So that's part of the soul food. I also have a telescope, and I take that out to go exoplanet hunting. It sounds super nerdy, but that's my soul food.
But also a lot of fun, it sounds.
Yeah, it is a lot of fun. And rocket launches. I love rocket launches. So.
Wait, so tell me about this rocket launch, because you said you're going on a rocket launch or doing a rocket launch next week.
I'm going next week. Yeah, it's let me tell you about it.
Please.
It's a SpaceX NASA resupply mission to the International Space Station, and I am so psyched to see it.
Gosh, okay. What do you love about this, about that?
Where do I even start? Okay. So I'm just like smiling really big
now. I can hear it.
Rocket launches really represent just humanity and how scientists and engineers work for years and years and years to create this mission. And in this moment, they'll see it come to fruition. They'll see it go up. And it also represents something, I think, which is so altruistic, that science belongs to posterity. It belongs to humanity. And when we push the boundaries of scientific knowledge, we are giving back to everyone. Everyone will benefit from it. And there's just this excitement that comes with just, you know, counting down the clock and seeing this rocket go up. But there's also a very human reminder that we can absolutely achieve things that we set out to do. I mean, this is like the dream of our ancestors, to send things to space and have it communicate back to us. And so space to me... every day I wake up and my burning question is, you know, what is our place in the universe and what am I going to do about it? And both space and civil rights activism answers those questions for me.
Totally. I don't know if you're familiar with Adrienne Marie Brown. We're going to have her on the show soon. And she wrote a book called Emergent Strategy, and also Octavia's Brood, which brings together social change activists and thinkers to write science fiction, kind of in the lineage of Octavia Butler. But the whole concept is exactly what you said, that the fight for civil rights is really, civil rights and social justice is really all about imagining a new world and then being bold enough to explore something beyond what you can see.
Yes.
Yeah, that's pretty perfect. But you are, I got to tell you, the first activist I know who is actively also doing rocket launches, which I think is pretty amazing.
It's going to be my 7th launch, and I am so excited.
That is amazing. That's amazing. Okay, so what would you tell now? I mean, and you've said this throughout. You've said a couple of different things throughout, but I'll ask you super directly. What would you tell a young woman, you know, who has experienced sexual assault, sexual violence, and is going through the same process that you were going through in the very beginning of confusion and of not knowing what to do and where to turn? What's the first piece of advice you would give her? And I know every situation specific, but if you can give some, I don't know, some highlight points.
Yeah, you're going to get through it. I wish, you know, I heard that from someone, because it's hard. You know, I would tell her, him or her, that I believe them, that it's going to be hard, but that they're going to get through it, and that it's going to be okay. And, you know, I just... Actually, this is hitting a very raw nerve, because today I had a conversation about this with a friend, and that's what I told her. You know, and it's hard. There are so many people. It happens to so many people. Mm-hmm. But you're gonna get through it, and there are people like me and the rest of the RISE team who are fighting every single day for your rights, so that the world would be better. Mm.
Now, for other folks who are both empathetic, but also ready to fight, right, who want to do something to make the world better for survivors and for all of us, what's the piece of advice you would give them?
It's totally possible, and please come join the movement. There are states that have not passed these civil rights yet, and of the 12 laws that we've passed, every single one of them have been unanimous. So it really isn't an uphill battle. It's literally about getting the momentum to get this in front of legislators and push it through to the finish line. There's not a person who's stopping this, right? We just need the force, the human power to make it into a reality. And this world of a fairer, more just place for rape survivors is so possible. So if anybody wants to make that concrete change, please join RISE, and you can find us at our website. That's risenow.us.
Last question. Did you have any fear or hesitation before stepping up? Because I know if I'm imagining someone listening to you and to your story and thinking it's so inspirational and so powerful, and maybe there's a huge percentage of people who are going to hear it and say, you know what, dude, yes, there's a bill I want to pass and I'm going to go do it. But
go
I imagine
it.
There's still, right? Like, please. But I imagine there's still some people who hear it and are like, but I just don't know if I can do that. Did you have any hesitation, or was it just kind of an instant, you know, this is a problem and this is how I'm going to solve it?
Of course I did. So first of all, I want to say that you can create change without sharing your story. So for any survivor out there, your story is yours to share. You have complete ownership over it. And if you want to make a difference, but you're not sure about speaking up, sharing your own trauma, that's totally your call. I totally had many hesitations, and I was scared. And you know what? I don't regret it at all. I don't regret it at all. And I can only speak for myself, right? Everybody has a different experience. Mm-hmm. I'm very privileged to have a supportive community around me, mm-hmm. Who like opened up their arms, but I was really scared. And there are people who have tried to label me and call me all the things in the world. And at the end of the day, I just knew very deeply that I was on the right side of history, mm-hmm. that I believed in these civil rights, and that this is what I'm going to fight for. And we made it happen.
And you're still working to make it happen now.
Yes.
For everybody. That's right. Thank you so much, Amanda, for answering your call, for doing this work for all, not just women here in the U.S., right, but for our community as a whole. Thank you so, so much. And thanks for being on the call today.
Of course. Of course.
I don't know about y'all, but I really needed to hear that this week. As cheesy as it sounds, you matter. Your voice matters. And it's still possible to make a difference no matter what your story, no matter how much of it you choose to share, and no matter how crazy the world gets. Thanks, Amanda, for that reminder. This week's episode was produced by the lovely Melody Rowell and published, as always, by Man Repeller. I'm your call tour guide, Erica Williams-Simon. And until next week, y'all know what to do. Keep loving, keep fighting, keep dreaming, and of course, keep answering your call. Peace, y'all.